Roguecast is the official podcast of Rogues Gallery Comics and Games. Every week we talk about new comic releases, store news, and whatever games, movies, and TV is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
This is Dave.
I'm Nick.
And now, on with the show. Welcome to Roguecast number 202. It's just me and Dave this week.
In celebration of 202, like a two-faced kind of crime.
Yeah, sure.
We're going with a duo sort of thematic. It's binary.
Yes, that's what it is.
Nick had family emergency stuff. Yep. He had to go help with. So Nick is out.
I can't think of any famous number 202 issues. Like 201, we were snapping off issues.
Yeah, it's true.
202, nothing jumps out at me.
Yeah, so if 201 was the Cyclops versus Storm, which, yeah, I remember that.
Yep.
What was 202?
I don't remember.
Man, yeah, I cannot recall it either.
Was that about the point you were leaving X-Men earlier?
I hung around, I want to say, till about 215 or 220. So right about when I think they disappeared out of the, was it Dallas Plaza or whatever it was?
Interestingly, that was actually when I first started reading X-Men. In fact, as I look at it, Uncanny X-Men 202 was one of the first comics I got as a subscription mailed to me when I was living in Denver.
Oh, wow.
It is the show, it has the Sentinels.
Okay.
Fighting Rogue and Magneto and Wolverine and Storm on the cover. It is a Secret Wars 2 tie-in.
Oh, okay, yeah.
When the Beyonder shows up and, like, summons Sentinels from the future to fight them.
I'm sure he's like, I don't understand this thing called racism. I'm going to bring in Sentinels to kill you.
What I remember is their Sentinels were scary. They, like, the future Sentinels were dangerous, and they give, Phoenix, Rachel Summers was having, like, flashbacks, and...
Well, you know, credit to John Byrne here. He was the one who wanted to do a Sentinel story that became Days of Future Past.
Yeah.
And Claremont was like, no, Sentinels suck. Sentinels aren't scary. And he's like, I can make them scary.
Yeah.
And ever since then, in the right hands, they've been scary.
They're scary.
Nimrod, when he shows up, is like the T-1000, just utterly unstoppable,
yep,
always upgrading and changing to outwit people. They can also be generic robots in the wrong hands.
Yep.
But in the right hands, scary.
Days of Future Past, I have both. When they were showed up in the set in the 80s, they were boring generic robots, but the, yep, future ones were kind of crazy scary.
Yeah, well, you know, they fastball specialed Wolverine at one of them, and it just turned and incinerated him.
Yep.
Nowadays he'd survive that because he would come back from a single cell.
Yeah.
But back then it was dead.
Yes. All right, store news. Just a reminder again that D&D Adventures League is now on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Call early on Tuesdays. We only have one DM at the moment.
Yep.
We have new news of the Action Comics No. 1000 Midnight Release. That is going to be Tuesday, April 17th, starting at about 10:30 p.m. We're going to run DC deck building game, maybe play some Superman cartoons or DC stuff on the TV.
Yep.
Come out. We're going to close up at 9 o'clock as usual, reopen about 10:30. Come play DC deck building with us, and then at midnight, we will sell Action Comics No. 1000 as well as all the other DC comics of the week.
Is DC going to hook us up with any kind of, like, Superman bags or any kind of gear?
No.
Bastards.
Yeah. They're just
Let's call it off.
All right. Never mind. We're not going to do it.
That'll be fun. We'll get our Superman on that night.
Then that Sunday, April 22nd, is our Magic the Gathering Dominaria pre-release, which that weekend is also something new. It is the first time ever we'll be selling booster boxes of Dominaria on pre-release weekend.
Right. It is the only thing that they will essentially be releasing that weekend, right?
Right.
But previously, the pre-release was if you were a player, that was the only way you would get... You were a player.
Yep.
That was the only way you could get access to any cards from the set, and then you had to wait a week like every other schmuck until it was officially released the following Friday. Mm-hmm. But now, booster boxes only will be, yep, available for purchase, so if you want to do that deep dive...
Yeah, you can pre-order a booster box. You will get the box and a...
Fancy buy-a-box card. Yep.
And we can sell them on Saturday and Sunday, so get those pre-orders in.
Yes.
Then April 28th, Saturday, April 28th, is International Tabletop Day. We'll, as always, be doing a bunch of different game demos, that kind of thing. We will have 10% sale on games that day.
Mm-hmm.
And... We'll have the whole list. You can look and see what the whole schedule is up on our website.
There's going to be some really cool games there.
But we'll read that off next week when we get a little closer.
Yep.
All right, news. There's only a couple items this week. But they're both
interesting. A couple fits our theme.
Yes, it does. Two news items.
Yes, everything must fit our theme.
Okay.
We will have two picks
each. We will
each
have two picks.
And if anybody starts to go over anything, that more than two on anything...
Dave will start screaming.
I will start screaming like a chimpanzee.
And there's two topics as well.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. I'm not going to have to scream.
It's the rule of two. So, first on the news item agenda is Astro City is getting TV treatment.
Yep. I don't know how much this impacts most people because I think it's fallen a little bit out of the spotlight. Mm-hmm. But in the 90s, you couldn't spit without hitting Astro City. Because it also... But anyway, it was an awesome book. Kurt Busiek was doing it. And it's basically the best thing he's ever done.
Yeah, it's great. We've talked about it on the podcast numerous times. But yeah, basically,
an anthology format superhero book
with real time aging and real time movement, and
it's a pastiche of both Marvel and DC elements from a guy who really knows those elements.
Yeah.
But instead of just telling like let's do an adventure story with these kind of like analogs to those characters, which by the way they're not just analogs. There's usually a lot more to them. I would say.
Yeah, for sure.
But he tells these very human stories that always have some sort of something that will allow you to kind of like feel closer to it. As strange as it may seem, there are relatable stories in there about everything from superheroes that are like Superman level power to criminals and stuff like that who show up. They are all well defined.
This is a series that really works in the comic book format. Mm-hmm. I'm a little curious to see how it works for TV. I can see it working for TV.
Right, well, like, there's no central character to it in the comics. They will generally do, like, one-shot or three-issue stories or whatever that are kind of about, sort of tend to be about the periphery of the heroes. You know, it might be a cop working there or some low-level criminal or whatever. But then sometimes there will be long, extended arcs about superpowered characters. And so the format changes up a little bit, and how do you adapt it to TV?
I don't know. I mean, maybe they do the anthology thing. Maybe they don't have an ongoing central character.
But it's going to be a high effects show, I think.
Yeah. The thing that makes me nervous is Powers.
Right.
The Sony
TV show Powers.
Did you ever watch the Powers TV show?
I believe what was it on? It was
on the PlayStation Network, sir.
Oh wow. They made the first episode available for free, I think.
Yeah,
right?
I think they might have.
I believe I watched that and I was like, oh.
It is not just bad, it was god awful.
Yeah.
And Powers is a show that should have worked on TV, so
right. It's essentially a cop procedural with the occasional cape.
My fear would be they turn Astro City into something like that.
Yeah.
But my hope is that they will do something that will sort of elevate superhero TV.
Well, you know, Busiek's big project that catapulted him to stardom initially in the 90s, even though he'd been around since at least the 80s, for all I know, the 70s, was Marvel's.
Yeah.
His four-issue painted miniseries for Marvel, which also kind of broke Alex Ross to the world.
Yep.
And it was told entirely from the perspective of a reporter living through all the big early events of the Marvel Universe. The rise of mutants, the formation of, like, the Avengers, so he kind of saw it all from throughout his life. And Astro City, you would have to kind of invent something like that, but I could see some singular character who kind of, through links to him, we will kind of catch many of these broader stories.
Yeah, I think you're right.
You know, I can almost see them taking like a character like Steeljack,
the criminal turned private eye. Yeah.
Yeah. He's a crook turned private eye. He's very physical. He looks like who's the actor? He looks like
Robert Mitchum.
He looks exactly like Robert Mitchum. He's an old school tough guy. And, but he's also like Robert Mitchum if Robert Mitchum turned into Colossus.
Yeah.
And, so he's walked on both sides. He would be an interesting protagonist who wouldn't be like squeaky clean, goody two shoes, kind of annoying. And he could be like talking to a buddy in a bar, and the guy could be like spin a tail, and that's what the episode is.
You could fit a lot. Yeah, you could fit a lot through Steeljack. Yeah, that's true.
But I have no idea. They could, if the anthology thing is certainly risky. But as somebody who likes standalone episodes in TV shows, I would be happy with the other. But that's not what most people like. Most people like the big mythology episodes that move a series along.
That's true. Although the interesting thing is, if you did an anthology in the same way as Astro City, you could use bigger actors and actresses because you only have to sign up for one episode.
That's true.
Of course, then if you want to bring them back, it's a little harder.
Right.
But one episode of TV a year, you know, if you cast somebody big to play Samaritan,
right,
and he only has to do one episode every year, he can do all his movies and then come in and do the one episode whenever you can fit that episode into his shooting schedule. I could see it. I don't know. We don't know too much about it, like where it's going to be or if it's going to go forward. But I'm really curious.
I really want it to come off, and it does have a lot of sort of dangers.
There's a lot of potential pitfalls, but if it works, it'll be great.
Yep. Also, everybody read Astro City.
Yes, everybody should read Astro City. And you don't have to read all of them. You can just pick up any given graphic novel.
It's true.
Because they're not all in print right now.
Right.
So, they have just this morning announced that the Dark Phoenix movie has been delayed until 2019, and that New Mutants, already delayed until 2019, has been delayed again.
When was Dark Phoenix going to come out? This year?
This Christmas.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I hadn't seen a single trailer for that, like even a teaser, which might be indicative of things. Do they say why?
Not really. New Mutants has sort of indicated that they want to amp up the horror vibe, but also they're adding like two characters.
Yeah, Nick was earlier telling me, and I think we had maybe even talked about this before, that one of the characters was supposed to be CG, leading a lot of speculation about Warlock.
Yeah. Now, we don't know anything, but everyone is speculating that's Warlock, and the other one is Nate Gray, which I think is just fanboys getting out of hand. Like, nobody has any information on this.
Nate Gray.
Yeah, X-Man.
Why would he be in there?
Some people like
X-Man. But he's not a new mutant.
I know.
Okay. I'm gonna be the voice of reason here and say that the special effects is for Magma.
Yeah.
It's for Amara, whatever her name was. And she's going to be creating a lot of volcanoes.
Yeah. I think it's a Spider-Ham, and they've made a Sony deal that it's going to be Spider-Ham is going to be the New Mutants. They're going to really amp up the horror of Spider-Ham.
I got to say, we know that Marvel Studios is going to probably before long have the X-Men in their hands.
They're just waiting on
legal stuff.
That all to work out, and if that's the case, they've got to already be thinking about how they want to reposition X-Men and all that kind of thing, which is going to leave these as kind of orphan projects.
Right. Like, if somehow they didn't happen, I'd be just fine with that.
Me too. The X-Men, I mean, I like the idea of the Dark Phoenix as a capper to the mostly okay X-Men movies that Fox has done.
The general, solid run that began with, who's the
First
director?
Class. Bryan Singer.
Well, yeah, Bryan Singer, way back when, and then,
but
Singer, he's been involved off and on since the First Class era, too.
And the X-Men movies have been somewhere between good to occasionally bordering on great to outright terrible.
Right. But I think there's only one among them, but you could, if you start counting up, like, Wolverine Origins
is the first really, really, really terrible one. X3 is pretty bad.
I was going to say, was that before or after?
X3 is before.
Okay.
It was a bad run. It was like X3 and then Wolverine Origins and then The Wolverine, which some people like, but I thought was pretty bad.
Yeah.
And then they came back and did First Class and Days of Future Past, which both have their issues. But I generally like, but some people hate.
Right.
And then there was
the new Wolverine movie that which went over well. Was that?
But that was after the. What was the third? What was the X-Men movie? Apocalypse.
Apocalypse,
which was terrible.
Yeah.
And then Logan, which I think is overrated.
I tend to think so too, but people love it.
Yep.
And I think they just needed to wait till Hugh Jackman became total all sinew.
Yes.
Like, till there was nothing but veins on his outside, and then they're like, we can like Wolverine again.
And then there's Deadpool, which I don't really count as part of the X-Men movies, but I guess technically counts.
Yeah, it's got Colossus running around, and he was in an X-Men team once upon a time.
So, yeah. It's funny, Dave, because I think a lot of people are like worried. The whole Fox News was terrible for a lot of people, not because of the corporate implications of, you know, mega corporation is going to own all our souls, which is absolutely going to happen.
Right.
But because they were worried that Deadpool wouldn't be R-rated anymore. I think you and I are probably two of the only comic fans in the world who are like, yeah, fine, whatever, don't do Deadpool anymore, we don't care.
Yeah. Yep. Now, New Mutants had, what's her name,
Maisie Williams is playing Rain and Sinclair, which is good casting.
And I feel like, almost like, if only for her, it will get released. But I haven't heard a peep about the Dark Phoenix movie.
Yeah.
And honestly, we know that, like, okay, yeah, it's going to be better than Brett Ratner's X3 version. But, like, what people remember about the original one, like, one of the biggest things is, like, a huge tangle with the Hellfire Club, which was awesome.
Yeah.
But also, it went cosmic in its very last part where the X-Men had to like fight to try and save her against the Shi'ar Imperial Guard.
Yep.
Amazing fight. The X-Men get their asses handed to them.
Yeah.
But they can't suddenly go cosmic in this. There's just no way.
And that's why I don't want them to do it. That's why I can actually see them burying this.
Could sabotage the potential for a Marvel Studios version, which
you know they would do
cosmic.
Yeah. And that's why I think they might bury it.
Yeah.
This and New Mutants both, because as one-off movies, they might not be that bad, but they would
tarnish the brand.
You want to do the Dark Phoenix saga a third time? It's going to be much harder.
Right. I do actually think Marvel could pull it off.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like if they, at the end of one of the Guardians movies, had somebody, you know, had, like, a ship get destroyed, like, you know, because the Phoenix Force is streaking towards Earth and they tried to intercept, everybody would freak their shit. Yeah. And would be like, oh, my God, they're going to do it right.
Yeah, well, and you introduce the Shi'ar and all that in Guardians. Yeah.
Yep. But it's still a little bit, like, it's going to be tougher if they have to make it past a one more bad Phoenix movie.
I don't know anything here, but I'm putting my money on this. They were delayed to see if they can get this deal worked out. And if those deals get worked out, these both are going to get killed or go straight to video, straight to Netflix or something.
Right, right.
Or play on Marvel's or Disney's new streaming channel when they...
I could see that.
Elseworlds stories.
The Lost Classic.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's very likely any of these movies ever see the light of day, and I think that's probably a good thing.
Yeah, I'm going to agree on this one.
All right. That takes care of our news for the week. We'll be back in just a second to talk about comics.
One familiar cry.
We are talking comics the week of Wednesday, March 28th, and I'm going to start off with the new Valiant series, Shadow Man number 1. Valiant has been on a winning streak for me for a while now. I mean, I buy all the Valiant stuff in hardcovers. I own almost all of it they put out in hardcover.
I forgot you were so fancy.
I actually really like the Valiant books, and I like to read them in bigger chunks. I've been reading through the Ninjak Volume 2 right now, and it's really good. But...
I didn't get around to reading this one, by the way, and I want to later on, if only because that awesome arresting cover of the dude with his cool voodoo marking mask or face.
I think the Valiant's been kind of a hard sell for a lot of people, and the one thing that Valiant does well is they have been sort of giving new jumping on points every now and then to give people a chance to get in.
Right.
And I think they're in kind of a streak right now because they have the new Ninjak, which is really good. And that's been doing pretty solid for us. And they have the...
there was that Archer and Armstrong special.
And they have Quantum and Woody, which is the other new one that's launched and done all right. So this is the next one in the, sort of their latest series of new books. It is Shadow Man number 1. And I have read the previous Shadow Man by Justin Jordan, which I really liked. But I don't know that I would necessarily say you have to have read any of the previous ones. This basically starts off with a woman going into the swamps of New Orleans with a gun and some voodoo magic, and she's basically looking for a cult that's been causing trouble. Turns out it's a trap, and in the course of all it, she basically winds up summoning Shadow Man from the dead side where he's been.
Right, I gathered just when I was writing up to making the sign for it that he had kind of maybe gone into some sort of almost self-exile?
Yeah, well,
his powers got out of control or something?
He wound up going to the dead side and then was taken over by Master Dark, their sort of master villain, and sort of turned into his henchman.
Mm-hmm.
That's happened in previous Valiant books. But the nice thing is, if you haven't read those books, you get all that here. It gives you a sense of, oh, here's this guy who was a hero, he's been gone, and he's been gone for 5 years.
Uh-huh.
Which is a pretty big thing to do, like, go ahead and move the timeline that much. But yeah, he's been gone for 5 years. He's been off being sort of this bad guy's henchman. He's not really sure who he is anymore, but there's a big threat, and now he has to go back into action.
Can you tell me what the basic concept of Shadow Man is? Like, who he is and what his powers are?
He is he has a Loa, you know, a voodoo spirit.
Yes.
Who has been exiled from the other Loa.
Uh-huh.
They don't know exactly why, but that Loa is sort of a renegade Loa. So it is part of him. It is something that has passed along the father-son line of his family.
Uh-huh.
So he's a former jazz musician who sort of has this Loa in him, and it gives him sort of speed and strength and some other abilities to see, you know, the supernatural and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And his archenemy is Baron Samedi.
Okay, yeah, the famous figure.
Sort of undead voodoo priest here.
Yep.
And he shows up here, and Shadow Man is sort of the supernatural warrior of New Orleans.
You know what's interesting is that although Marvel has Brother Voodoo, who became Dr. Voodoo, I guess, they never sort of ran too much with the voodoo element, it seemed like, with him, you know, like maybe outside of the 70s comics that introduced him.
Right.
So it's like this is a weirdly kind of almost untapped thing for such a well-known sort of supernatural concept as voodoo. It doesn't sort of show up too much in comics.
It's true.
But there's all kinds of cool imagery and stuff related to it and ideas, and it has, you know, historical roots and all this stuff. I don't even remember. Is Baron Samedi, was that, like, based on a real guy?
Yeah, I believe it is.
He was, like, an actual person at some point. But that sounds really cool, like in sort of a, you know, a creepier Doctor Strange kind of comic.
Yeah. And this is written by Andy Diggle, who I'm a big fan of.
Oh, yeah. And my favorite project of him was probably his Green Arrow Year One, but he also did The Losers, which was awesome as a comic, if not as a movie.
He's also the artist by Steven Segovia, who's done a bunch of work for DC and Marvel. He's worked on Dark Wolverine. He's worked on Superman. And he worked on Ninjak previously for Valiant. It's really nice art. It's sort of classic superhero art, I would say, with a little bit of that painty look that Valiant sometimes has.
Upside down, it reminds which is how I'm looking at it as you're flipping through it. It reminded me of like one of those strong realists like Jim Chung.
Yeah.
Or one of those kind of guys who's like realistic in the best ways.
Yeah, I can see that. Anyway, I recommend it. I always like Valiant, and I think Shadowman number one is a good jumping on points.
Shadowman.
Dave, what is your pick?
I'm going to pick issue 600 of a book, which is issue 600 of Daredevil.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have not been keeping up with Daredevil that much in the last year, but I decided to just kind of jump in on this one and see what's going on.
And it's funny because it's the culmination of the Mayor Fisk storyline that's been going on.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. But it was pretty cool to see, and it's also got a sort of lead into... Well, let's see. Is that an actual preview in the back?
No, it's a regular one-off story.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's right. That's right. But yes, in this culmination, you know, so Kingpin, the big thing, of course, he became mayor of New York.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of the definitely a ultimate sort of victory for him. And in a way, you know, like, I don't know if how much they've been doing this, but like, all the comics have been doing various allegories and stories that absolutely reflect our current president.
Yes.
This one seems like a kind of more obvious, but like it makes sense the most, because Kingpin was always going to be a guy who was kind of not like him. He was Kingpin's effective, but he is a you know, he has the monomaniacal kind of, you know, thing going on. And in this, basically, the defenders of the Marvel Universe, that is to say, as in the style of the Netflix show, which includes Daredevil and his buddies, so it's like Moon Knight, Jessica Jones, Iron Fist, Cage, Spider-Man,
Echo.
Echo, and Misty Knight.
Yeah.
And I think that's everybody.
Yeah.
They are all sort of working together, and there's their, like, super cool art, by the way. I don't know who the artist is. There's
Ron Garney.
Oh, it's Ron Garney, man.
Garney's been doing good stuff on this book.
He really has. That's right. I forgot he's been with it since, like, Sewell's run, right?
Yeah.
They're trying to sort of stake out a big meeting going on between the Kingpin and all the various... crime lords of New York, so it's like the Owl and Hammerhead and all those other guys you know from Spider-Man and Daredevil comics. And there's like that meeting between that and the superhero stakeout of it. I don't want to say too much about it, but it sort of escalates to violence, and you see that the Kingpin has an ulterior plan going on and is definitely pulling some strings and is being smart, which I appreciate and dig. There's a backstory I didn't know too much about. Who's the guy he's training?
Blindspot.
Blindspot, and he's facing off against somebody who must be like his sort of arch foe type person.
He's an inhuman serial killer artist. Yeah. Muse,
I have to ask, he looks like he's wearing a mask, and on the mask it looks like there's blood coming down from the eye holes as if he's wrenched his eyes out.
Yeah.
That, I assume, that clearly he even mentions doing something like that.
Well, he basically blinded Blindspot.
Yeah.
And something happened, I think it was a magical thing where Blindspot got his eyes back.
Right. Now, the blood that's on Muse, is that like... just part of, like, his weird artistic affectation?
Yeah.
It's not like that's actual blood that just happened, right?
No. I think his inhuman power is, like, strength and speed.
It is creepy looking, though. This guy with this... It reminds me a little bit of the dude... who's the guy with the claws in Street Fighter? Vega.
Oh, yeah.
He looks like Vega if Vega had blood dripping down from his eye holes.
Yeah.
and he has the same sort of creepy factor as Vega.
Yep.
By the way, I have to point out one little minor thing I didn't like here. Sewell didn't invent this. It's just that at the meeting of the mobsters... I never fully liked the notion that Black Cat would become a mob boss.
That's a Dan Slott thing.
Yeah, I guess he was sort of empowering her, you know, kind of a admittedly a Catwoman clone.
Yeah.
But I sort of felt like she had already sort of broken apart and become her own character and escaped that sort
I don't
of
like it either. I understand the motivation behind it to sort of give her more, but I don't like
and
it.
And it's
either.
Even relatively well handled here.
Sure.
It's just not my thing. Anyway, there is a pretty dramatic and brutal combat between Muse and Blindspot here.
Yep.
And then without saying too much, that there is a full-on face-off in this again between Daredevil and Kingpin.
Yeah.
In the brutal tradition, I guess, I'm going to say that goes back specifically to Daredevil Born Again.
Yeah.
To this day, probably the most brutal fight I've ever seen between those two characters. Yeah. But this one has some, an interesting concept, an interesting weapon added to the mix, and some excellent staging. And an ending that is, to all these things, that is rather surprising and sets the stage for, I guess, what is to come.
Yep.
So anyway, I was happy to have kind of jumped in even in the middle of things. I felt like I very quickly got caught up and I didn't need to know anything else. And I think some people might want to pick up the 600th issue just to see the finale, and check it out as a historical thing too.
Yep.
Randy's second pick?
My second pick is Champions number 18, which is the finale of the Mark Waid Humberto Ramos run. They've had 18 issues on this thing. I really love this book from the outset, and they did the crossover with Avengers. It lost its footing a little bit, but they generally have been doing pretty interesting things with it. They brought a bunch of new characters in. They brought in, Falcon, Ironheart, Red Locust, which is the character they created, Patriot, Wasp.
Are these are regular members?
Yeah, they were members for the last like six issues.
Okay.
And then they're doing this big story.
How big is the team? 12 people?
It's pretty big. But they've been doing the story that sort of focused on Viv Vision. She became human.
Uh-huh.
The High Evolutioner created a human version of her. And then the android version was sort of like going a little crazy, and there was a virus, and it looked like basically the two of them were being pitted against each other. Well, this resolves all of that, resolves the Vision story in a way that I really liked. It also has a great moment between Cyclops and Ms. Marvel, where she sort of talks about how, she's like, were you ever really a kid? And he tells a story about when he was seven and he, like, rescued a school bus full of kids because the driver had a heart attack and he had to jump in and save it. And how Ms. Marvel sort of gets how, yeah, he had to grow up really soon because his dad wasn't super responsible. And,
right.
And it's a good... It's
what happens when your dad's a space pirate.
It's another great... Wade gets Cyclops. He actually talks in the back of the text piece about how he wasn't sure he was going to be able to get Cyclops on loan from the X-Office. That's one of his favorite characters. He was glad to get him. So there's a nice little moment for Cyclops and Ms. Marvel that sort of writes him out of the book. And there's sort of a... It's sort of a finale to the run that Wade and Ramos have set up. With the big, let's go save the world ending, which is going to lead into Jim Zubs taking over the book and seeing where he goes. Whether or not it continues to be great, I don't know. He's bringing in a couple of members I'm glad to see. He's going to, change up the roster to a more of a slimmed down roster with some new characters in it. And whether or not it continues, I don't really care because this was just a great run. And I'm hoping we'll get like a big hardcover at some point.
I need to catch up on that and pick up some of the collections, perhaps when the big hardcover comes out.
Yep.
Because I liked all the early issues and I just fell off at some point. But yeah, I like the character lineup. I liked Ms. Marvel, Nova, what do you call it?
Miles,
Viv,
Amadeus. Yeah.
It's a good loadout. And of course, I am also a Cyclops fan, so anybody can get him right.
Yeah. I think none of them get the full spotlight I would have liked from them. None of them ever get that full... even though it's 18 issues, I feel like they never quite got their feet underneath them.
Do you wanted like more character spotlight issues?
I wanted more story. I feel like all these stories, they did some interesting stuff with it, but I feel like there was still plenty of mileage on these books, and I feel like they were just getting started. I feel like the Avengers crossover interrupted everything.
Yeah, you know what this reminds me of in a sort of roundabout way is way back in the 80s, Alpha Flight.
Yeah.
Alpha Flight was a book where I really enjoyed it as it was going along. It was kind of John Byrne's Canadian Defenders, a weird team.
Yeah.
And it, like, almost the status quo for them was that they didn't have a status quo. There would be weird solo issues and stuff like that. Always a good time, but like I would have liked to have seen them stay on the book and like continue to develop it for a long time. And see where it would go. I'll look forward to checking this one out though.
Dave, what's your backup pick?
And speaking of sort of collected editions, I'm picking the first time I believe in soft cover, or is this just back in print, Randy?
It's been a while since we've had it. I don't know it's been a long time.
It's the big one volume collection of Annihilation, the sci-fi series from Marvel that really put sci-fi back on the map. from kind of pioneered by Keith Giffen and Dan Abnett and Andy Lanning, but a few other writers too. I forgot Keith Giffen writes about three quarters of
these. He was heavily involved,
But it set the stage for what would become the Guardians of the Galaxy, which was the sort of in the second part of Annihilation. Follow-up.
This brought Nova to prominence.
Yep.
Had a surprising villain. Maybe not surprising if you know the name. Look at the name. You're like, oh, that makes sense. But I didn't remember.
I mean, I think at this point we can say who it is.
It was Annihilus.
It was 10 years ago. Yeah. Annihilus, who is traditionally a Fantastic Four bad guy, usually kind of a bent on world domination, alien dictator type, has like... his whole world or his universe is making like an incursion into his negative zone. It's negative zone, right?
Yeah.
Into the regular universe with what they call the Annihilation Wave, and it's all these like little sort of feeding sort of little insectoid creatures. They look sort of like the artists all drew them a little bit differently, but they were just like this...
the bugs from the Wreck-It Ralph movie, actually.
Yeah, it was like these quasi-armored, metallic, locust-y creatures just destroying whole planets, wrecking the Nova Corps. And this was a series of miniseries that all sort of tied together. One of them, the Drax miniseries... I think had the least tie to it.
Well, because it was pre-Annihilation.
Yeah, it was pre-Annihilation. It's only in like the last few pages that it's like he kind of gets called away or whatever. But it did rebuild Drax from the guy who kind of flew around and energy blasted stuff and in some incarnations was like a big dope.
Yeah.
To becoming this almost more, we decided, Riddick-style guy.
Yeah.
Who he literally breaks into like a hunting store here and like emerges with knives, Riddick-style... and becomes this machine of death. So the first miniseries focuses on him. There's another one that focuses on Quasar. Quasar is somewhere in here, but...
Quasar's not till Conquest.
I swear I saw him
I think he appears, but he's in the one-shot.
Maybe I saw the...
The miniseries are Nova, Silver Surfer, and...
Super Skrull. And aside from those sort of disparate miniseries, it also includes the Annihilation Prologue Special, which was a super cool thing that like led into the big main story.
Right.
It was drawn by Scott Collins. He got to do kind of all those big characters. And they included something that a lot of these issues had that I really liked, which is their own sort of little bio write-ups on the characters. Mm-hmm. So if you're like, oh, I can't remember quite what the deal is with Fire Lord, you know, that's one of those Heralds of Galactus. He shows up in the Silver Surfer miniseries of this. Or some even the leads, like Super Skrull and stuff like that. They've got a good write-up from them that I think, let's see... I wasn't sure if Abnett and Lanning themselves wrote it up, but it has some of their sort of, I think, thought and inventiveness to the... They were sort of rethinking these characters in kind of a cooler science fiction way and not just making them, like, superheroes in space. There was a little bit more of a science fiction bent.
Yeah.
And honestly, that was a thing throughout this, stories that had to be sort of personal and real, but also that had to feel like... the same way the Guardians, of the Galaxy would redefine the Marvel movies and sort of make it really feel like a big shared sci-fi universe, this ended up doing the same for Marvel. So if by chance you missed it, I feel like it's a no-brainer to pick up on this one.
This was 12 years ago. It was 2005, 2007 when they probably published all this. And we were all super into it.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember it was like among the staff here, it was like, man, this was the coolest thing ever. But it was still always slightly a sleeper thing among readers.
Yeah.
Even when it spun off and started doing the Guardians of the Galaxy stuff, which is the exact same, basically the same team, Groot, Rocket, and all that stuff.
Yeah.
That would become the movie characters. Even then, it was not huge. It was still a cult book.
It did well for us because we hand sold it, but it wasn't. Right. Yeah, it wasn't a big blockbuster.
Yeah.
Which only goes to show you. You should listen to us, because what we love is going to become super huge movies, and look how kind of the curve you'll be.
Yep, and not only will you have read these great stories, you can then sell the individual comics you bought and become millionaires.
That's true. Good
point. Because if there's one thing that we're into here, it's investing in comics for a profit.
No, yes. Yes, very much that's our thing.
So I just meant to say, just read the good stuff. All right, I got a few other books in
wait, what about Nick's picks?
What about Nick's picks? Nick is not here, but we know what he would pick.
He told us.
But if he hadn't, we would have picked this anyway. It would have just been a question of which one was number one, which one was number two.
So these are long delayed. They both came out the same day. They've both been long awaited, and that is Doomsday Clock number 4.
Yep. No, Nick is a big DC nut.
And Dark Knight's Metal number 6, both of which. So both of which finally came out. Dark Knight's Metal 6 wraps that story up.
Yep.
Doomsday Clock is the origin of their Rorschach.
Yep.
And Nick liked them both.
I was flipping through Dark Knight's Metal number 6.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, as someone who has not been following closely, I was like,
what the hell? Utter gibberish.
But I could tell it had what looked to me like a cool ending in there. And what Nick was saying is that it was setting up a whole bunch of other things that are clearly going to be happening in the DC universe. Mm. So, and it makes sense with as huge an ensemble as it had. He also told me something about the nature of some cool planning and some crazy Grant Morrisonian type ideas they had for dealing with some of the, I think the, I forget what they call them, the Dark Knights or whatever, the evil Batman dudes.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, that's pretty clever. That's that. Ghost Nick picks those.
In absentia.
In absentia, yes. All right, now can I go? My other stuff. All right. I've had a little bit of a fondness for comic book versions, adaptations of Goosebumps, not because I grew up with them, but just because Scholastic put out a graphic novel adaptation or several, and at least the first two I thought were pretty exceptional, and they've had some good ones since. This is a single issue miniseries, I guess, called Goosebumps Download and Die. You had to say it like that. But it had a neat premise. There's a sort of a slightly fractious relationship between three friends in high school. One of them, sort of the new girl, instantly bonds with somebody, and the former best friend feels like she's the odd man out.
Mm-hmm.
And during the course of things, her phone gets stepped on and broken, and she will later find, sent in like the mail or found in a box outside her door, seemingly the most up-to-date high-tech iPhone you can get. She has no idea how it came about, but it's like, she's like, oh wow, it's even got my information already on it. It's also got these strange apps on it, which I don't get. There's even some weird games that are kind of seem strange. And
I don't think that's probably a good idea.
This is I'm going to just say it's a cursed phone.
Of course it's a cursed phone.
It has some creepy, fun ideas. It's not so scary that your kid could, you know, would be freaked out reading it. Yeah. Only perhaps slightly chilled. but it's a solid, fun first issue. Let's see. I haven't read this yet, but the second issue of Mira, right? Aquaman's girlfriend?
Sure, Aquaman's girlfriend.
Queen of Atlantis. She's also Queen of Atlantis, Randy. Jesus.
Yeah, okay, whatever.
Now, actually, she has been a pretty notable character really in the entire run from Rebirth onward.
Yeah.
And I like the first issue of this. This kind of, she has been, you know, we know from Aquaman that basically there is a magical sort of spell, real deep magic that is walling off Atlantis. If you're looking for your real world analogs, you don't have to think too hard on this one. But it is sort of success. Unlike the real one, this one actually exists and is successful too. So she cannot. Aquaman is leading his sort of like stealth rebellion down Atlantis below, and she cannot get in to help him. And so she's freaking out on the surface, and what she's been doing has actually been interesting and personal and cool. So I recommend that. Second issue of Lockjaw. First one was fun and did some good stuff with D-Man, who ended up the surprise owner of Lockjaw. For those Crow devotees, and I know you're out there, there's a new series, miniseries called Memento Mori. If I'm not mistaken, the Crow comics a few years ago, Randy, introduced a new Crow, essentially another man, you know, out on a mission of vengeance. So yep. I think for similar reasons. I think girlfriend killed, him killed. I don't know what differentiated it, but I'm sure he has a different MO and different sort of abilities.
Different M. Crow.
Whoa. I see what you did there. And I approve. But anyway, new Crow miniseries there. Mother Panic becomes the final Young Animal book to get this kind
it's
of
relaunch,
a
yep.
rethink relaunch.
This one's called, what is it officially called?
Mother Panic Gotham AD.
Okay.
And it's set like 10 years in the future.
Not Mother Panic Gotham AF.
That would have been more fitting the language style of it.
10 years in the future?
10 years in the future, I don't know why, but there is, basically from when I was making the sign for it, I learned all of this. Okay. There is no Batman.
Okay.
And the Joker seems to be this sort of pathetic, washed-up guy who's, like, I believe making sort of violent balloon animals and stuff for people.
Sure, okay.
And I gather becomes almost maybe something of, like, if not a confidant, maybe a Hannibal Lecter-esque informant or something. Okay. So I don't know what's going on, but it sounded interesting. I was flipping through it in the art, who maybe is the same person who's been drawing it from the beginning, Ibrahim Mustafa.
Mm-hmm.
Art looked amazing on it. You know, there's a lot of we've had a lot of issue number twos this week. Here's another notable one: the Terrifics.
Yeah.
They're DC's Fantastic Four. For some crazy reason, they have not so far reprinted the first issue, even though people are in high demand for it, have been demanding it all over the place. I feel like it's almost got to happen. But anyway, second issue is out, folks. There's tying into the Damnation storyline and Doctor Strange. There's a new miniseries called Johnny Blaze Ghost Rider.
It's actually just a one-shot.
Oh, so it's a one-shot. Oh, okay. Tying into that story, did you read it, Randy?
I did. I really liked that one. It's
cool.
It's actually got some really interesting stuff. It's Johnny and the Ghost Rider have been separated. They're basically... he winds up in hell, and he and Ghost Rider...
Only in comics is that just kind of a casual thing. So this one is going to be in hell.
Yeah, he's in hell. He and Ghost Rider are separated... And they have a plan, and I don't want to give too much away about it, but it's really interesting, it was really fun, it was a good take on Johnny Blaze, and I enjoyed it a lot.
Nice, I like Johnny Blaze. And lastly, even though Ghost Nick mentioned it, I just have to remind people, Doomsday Clock number 4 hit this week. I have not actually had time to read this one, but I know it is a Rorschach-centric issue,
yep.
That is to say, the new Rorschach, kind of his origin, so pretty notable.
Yep.
Randy, anything else of note?
Yeah, so I've been really enjoying the Damnation story in general. I finally got around to reading the Ben Reilly Scarlet Spider part that comes out this week, and I like that too. It's I think it's Peter David. Yeah, it's Peter David. So it's got this sort of jokey vibe. He's clearly doing something, channeling sort of his Supergirl run in here.
Mm-hmm.
But it was fun, and I liked. Looks like he's gonna, as always, when he brings in a crossover, David likes to do something that ties in. And there's going to be something that I think goes forward from here and ties into Scarlet Spider. So it's not just a one-off of, hey, he's in this story.
Right.
And then Old Man Hawkeye number 3 comes out, which I've been really liking. And they bring in some interesting characters I would not have expected. They're using the Thunderbolts, which Hawkeye at one point led. And it's interesting because in this world where the villains have sort of taken over, the Thunderbolts are sort of a no man's land of... Yeah, we were traitor villains, so we don't get much love as from the villains or the heroes, and they've had to sort of scrape by, and there's a great bit of like what Atlas is up to in this universe and what Hawkeye has to go through with him. It's really good. I'm a big Hawkeye fan. This sort of post-apocalyptic Hawkeye story, I'm actually liking a lot more than I liked Old Man Logan.
That sounds like a nice, pretty deep cut in there. I dig it.
Yeah. What else, Dave?
That's all I've got.
Okay. That takes care of comics for us for the week. We'll be back in just a moment to talk about a movie and a TV show. Two things, because it's rule of two.
Talking about comics, movies, and fame. They even talk about board games. No week is the same.
All right, real quick this week, I wanted to mention a couple things that I've been watching. The season 2 of Santa Clarita Diet showed up on Netflix.
Yep.
Dave, you never watched any of this, right?
I got to the point of, like, bookmarking it or whatever at, it's on Netflix,
yeah.
Right? Yeah, Netflix original. And I just haven't gotten around to it. But, like, I'm kind of, like, hyped to check it out. It's their weird zombie comedy thing.
Yeah, it's a half-hour comedy. I binged the whole thing in one day.
How many episodes in a
10
season?
10 episodes per.
Okay.
So the second season just ended. I liked the first season, but actually the second season is even better. It's Drew Barrymore and Timothy Olyphant playing a married couple. She becomes a zombie.
Mm-hmm.
And they also have a teenage daughter.
And you can still function as a zombie in this world once you've turned?
Yeah, yeah. They're like, as time goes on, she starts falling apart a little bit. And the first season is all about sort of finding a cure for it. The second season, they find sort of a cure. But they also introduce a couple new zombies. The reasoning behind why the zombies happened is introduced in this one, which is kind of funny. And there's a pair of sort of paranormal investigators looking for them. There's sort of a side story going on.
Uh-huh.
And they're also dealing with, you know, what it is to be sort of killers, because they have to kill people. And so they go looking for people to kill. And in this season,
who's your husband?
Timothy Oliphant.
Oh, that's awesome. I always like him.
He's really funny.
You know, here's the thing. First of all, I would not have necessarily thought that's a funny guy.
Yeah.
But he's talented. I'm not surprised at all he can pull it off.
Yep.
I like Drew Barrymore. I have a crush on Drew Barrymore.
Yep.
And Will for Life.
Yep.
But I don't know that I've ever thought of her as, like, a great actress or, like, had a strong sense of, like, her overall chops.
She's good here.
Yeah, like the closest I can think of, because I don't see too many of those romantic comedies she was in.
Yeah.
Actually, you know what I think about it? One time I saw that one. What's the one that had her and Hugh Grant, like, Words and Lyrics, or Lyrics and Music and Lyrics?
I don't know.
Anyway, I saw that one time. Actually, pretty good. She's like a lyricist. He's a washed-up singer who had, like, a Rick Astley-esque hit, I think, or something like that. It's cute.
Okay.
And then there's the Charlie's Angels movies and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I guess I actually do kind of like her. I just wasn't sure how she'd function in a sitcom type situation.
She's really good here.
Not sitcom-ish.
It's funny because I think iZombie, which I really like, which is a similar premise about, you know, zombies in the real world, that kind of thing. iZombie is about, like, she's a medical examiner and there are cops and there's a lot of things where zombies could be useful. Those skills could be useful.
Right.
And they're sort of skilled at getting away with things so they can hide things a little bit better. These guys are a couple of realtors in Santa Clarita, California. They are not great at this.
Yeah.
And in fact, Timothy Olyphant, I feel, is kind of almost like a dim bulb a little bit.
Yeah.
And it works. He's really the sort of a charming kind of dim bulb.
I can see it.
It works. It's really funny, and I definitely recommend it. The other thing is, it's getting a wide release this week, but it is limited release in a couple theaters, is sort of south in Austin, and that is Wes Anderson's Isle of Dogs, which I went and saw on Saturday.
I've been hearing generally very good things about this from people.
I'm a big Wes Anderson fan.
Yep.
I also, Fantastic Mr. Fox, his previous one that was sort of a, you know, anthropomorphic animals.
Stop motion.
Was one of my favorites. I have been anticipating this movie for like 2 years since I first heard about it. And
it stunk.
I completely loved it.
Oh, okay. You also like dogs.
I do like dogs.
So.
And yeah, it was... It's really good. It's really weird.
Sure.
It's got stunning music. It's got great visuals. It's got that sort of weird twee sense of humor that
sure.
is so well known.
One
for.
Thing I've noticed is like when the trailers sort of come up, no matter what kind of movie audience I'm with, they always seem a little bit like not sure what to do with it in their head. Like,
yeah.
Is this funny? It's not set up like traditional jokes and stuff like that. It's not the usual way goofy comedies are or animated movies tend to kind of run with their kind of kid-friendly, jokey stuff. So it seems both kind of sophisticated and sort of absurdist, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, the closest thing I compare it to is maybe almost like the Coen brothers,
mm-hmm.
you know, a little art house, a little bit, in, you know, insane.
Yeah.
But usually there is like, there or not usually, but often there's kind of a certain heart in their movies. And would you say Wes Anderson has that kind of, like, not always heart, but something like it?
Yeah, no, there's always a bit of heart. It's always a little bit dysfunctional, but...
I'm going to go with that description. Not really heart, but something like it.
Yeah. No, there's definitely some heart in this movie. There's some tear-jerking moments. The voice cast is astounding. The main voices are Bryan Cranston, Edward Norton, Bob Balaban, Bill Murray, Jeff Goldblum. There's also, like, Scarlett Johansson's in it, Harvey Keitel... F. Murray Abraham, Yoko Ono playing a scientist named Yoko Ono, Tilda Swinton, Ken Watanabe.
Yeah, what's his name? Wes Anderson seems to be able to, like, he's reached the Woody Allen point without tipping
point.
Over
yeah.
into Woody Allen destruction, self-destruction
yeah.
point, but he's reached that point that Woody Allen was at where he could say, come be in my movie, and whoever it is says yes.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, I really dug this. I recommend everybody go see it. I definitely want to see it a few more times. It's great stuff. All right, that's it for us this week. We'll be back next week with more. Until that time,
yo, Joe!
Thanks for listening. If you like the show, do us a favor and spread the word to your friends. Or give us a quick 5-star rating and review on iTunes to help us grow our audience. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or at www.roguesgallerytx.com. We'll be back next week.